Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio still is Persephone, and on the line from Maine is Nate. We're talking now, obviously, about the situation in Iraq. This is a fast-moving situation. I'm sure there will have been 5 million different developments between the time we're recording this on Sunday, August 10th, and when this is actually broadcast and released on the internet on Wednesday. But we're going to go over some of the things that have been happening since our last show a couple weeks ago. Nate and I had been talking several weeks back about the situation in northern Iraq, but it has gotten very serious at this point. We've got basically three or four different things happening with ISIS, Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or sometimes Islamic State and in Iraq and the Levant. They've now just started calling themselves Islamic State, which for some reason the entirety of Western media has just agreed to call them Islamic State now. Say IS, formerly known as ISIS, but I'm not going to dignify that with any kind of recognition. So we'll just call them ISIS. But a number of things that have been happening there. You know, they had captured Mosul back in June, very serious situation. But then they've captured a number of other very problematic targets of military and humanitarian value. They captured Mosul Dam. That's the largest hydroelectric dam in Iraq. It's located on the Tigris River, very far north near the border of Turkey, north of the city of Mosul. And they also have surrounded this place called Mount Sinjar. And we'll get to that in a second. Additionally, the United States has now started airstrikes. And we'll get into this in just a second as to why that is. But the main thing that prompted this was that ISIS missile launchers and mortars and stuff, artillery pieces basically, had gotten so close to Erbil, the regional capital of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, where most of the U.S. presence outside of Baghdad is located, that this was deemed a threat that the United States couldn't not respond to, essentially. The city was starting to evacuate, and they basically figured that if the city evacuated itself, then there was going to be no one left to defend any of the Americans, and it was just going to be a huge morale problem. So they almost immediately started airstrikes from drones and fighter jets and stuff after that. So that's the situation with Erbil. But as a result of the new advances in north and south of Mosul, we've now seen 200,000 people in the week before we're recording this episode, from Monday through, I think, Friday or Saturday, 200,000 people moving from outside of the Iraqi Kurdistan region into the Kurdistan region, making a total of 500,000 refugees at this point. We're seeing cities emptying out of their Christian populations, their Yazidi populations, any minority groups especially are just fleeing in advance of this. And now that ISIS forces started entering within the boundaries of the Kurdish region, we're seeing those people starting to move as well southward to the other major city, Sulaymaniyah. And this is a huge game changer because up to this point, the Kurdish regional government's troops, the Peshmerga troops, which were kind of under the command of the two major political parties there, had been basically the best force, undisputed, in Iraq and possibly one of the best forces in the entire region. The Iraqi military, for decades now, has been one of the most atrocious militaries ever created. They're wildly incompetent at everything. And everyone was not surprised when they fell back and abandoned Mosul. But it's a big deal when the Kurdish troops start falling back. A lot of that, apparently, they say, was that they were not being given weapons and ammunition by the central government in Iraq, but were also being expected by the central government in Baghdad to defend all these different cities outside of their own territory, including Kirkuk, which is a big one that Nate and I talked about several weeks ago. So they're being, basically, all these demands are being placed on them by the central government in Baghdad that has no competent military, but they're not being supplied because that government was afraid that this was going to embolden the separatism and make it possible for them to function on their own. And that's, you know, a serious problem. It seems to be maybe it's getting fixed a little bit now because of the situation where they had to start retreating. That really seemed to scare Baghdad enough to start giving them weapons. I think a lot of the weapons are going to have to come from the United States, though, which trusts them a lot more. The United States, longtime allies with the Kurds, as we've talked about many times on this show. I also think it's possible we might start seeing Turkey providing weapons to the Kurdish regional government in Iraq, and that would be a very significant development because they hate them, or they used to. Nate and I discussed at length about how that kind of evolved into a different relationship, but for the longest time, they really did not like them. But the Islamic State, the ISIS forces pose a much bigger threat, I would argue, to Turkey, even if they don't invade Turkey. If they cause a massive million-person refugee situation on top of all the other refugees from the Syrian civil war, that's a huge problem for Turkey and a much bigger one than Kurdish separatism in southwest Turkey, which has been sort of neutralized diplomatically for the moment. So that's obviously been a concern. At Mount Sinjar, we've got 40 to 50,000 Yazidi refugees. These are a minority religious group. They mostly speak Kurdish, but they're not Muslim. Some sources say, oh, it's a 4,000-year-old religion. It's basically got elements of old, ancient Mesopotamian things going on, your classical faiths from Persia, Mithraism, various Abrahamic traditions.
Zoroastrianism.
Yep. And in particular, ISIS considers them to be quote-unquote devil worshippers.
Yeah, apparently some of the, I guess, animist elements, they believe that it's a Satan worshiping, basically, and Lucifer and all that. So
yeah, the angel that we in Western tradition refer to as Lucifer is known as Azazel in Islam. In the Muslim tradition, as well as the, you know, sort of Christian John Milton type traditions, the belief was that the angel Lucifer or Azazel was cast out for not being obedient to God or something like that, or trying to lead a rebellion and then fell to hell and was condemned to be Satan or Shaitan there. And the tradition in the Yazidi faith is actually, no, God had specifically said, do not bow to mankind or anyone else. And then later said, as a test, I guess, to all the archangels, said, okay, I've created this, you know, mankind from dust and mud. Now bow down to him. And then this angel said, no, you said not to. And then God was like, good remembering. And then decided that meant that he could be the lead angel, the head of all the archangels. And so it's like, oh, all
as
the
for
other
the peacock angel.
Yeah, all the other angels, they bowed down and they weren't supposed to. But Azazel had a better long-term memory. And then apparently this is why they think that this means that they're devil worshippers. I don't know. Seems to me like not the biggest point in the world to go, you know, start trying to massacre people over. But the Yazidis have faced apparently over 70 attempts to commit total genocide on their population, including some by Saddam Hussein. They're a very small population at this point, spread out across the world, but mostly still concentrated in Iraq. And so 50,000 of them, which is obviously a big chunk of their total global population, is trapped on Mount Sinjar. I looked on some maps there. Basically, Mount Sinjar is this 25-mile long ridge line and 10-mile wide thing. So it's sort of like a big mountain or a series of mountains, depending on how you want to look at it. It's right near the border with Syria. So some Syrian Kurds were then trying to break out some of these people, but they're trapped without food and water. And they were starving there. So we've also seen Turkish military and U.S. military airdrops, along with British supplies, although no British planes, of food and water to those people. But they're surrounded by ISIS, which is planning to kill them. They've basically said, yeah, we're going to kill everyone there. And so that's sort of that humanitarian situation. So Persephone, on the humanitarian side, some of these airstrikes were done to protect this population and help support the airdrops that were coming in under fire. What do you think about this operation?
Well, of course, it's always a complicated issue when you're talking about airstrikes. But I think in this case, I mean, it's really something that's necessary. I mean, we're talking about protecting people in a very literal sense. It's not like an abstract sort of we're against these ideals, we're going to do this. It's really a way of defending people against attempted genocide, really.
Right. Life or death situation that's immediately present. Nate, what was your take on the start of airstrikes here and these humanitarian aid drops?
We're beginning to reinsert ourselves into this pretty complicated situation in Iraq. I mean, I'm not particularly upset or excited one way or the other. I think that this is probably the correct course of action just for right now because, you know, we have this, you know, religious minority, ethnic minority who are potentially on the verge of almost being completely wiped out. And that's something that is completely unacceptable. And, you know, whether we can do anything to support them with food and some limited airstrikes is probably a worthwhile endeavor. However, I'm now somewhat worried that, you know, we talk a lot about mission creep and all sorts of stuff like that. You wonder how difficult it will be and how much we'll have to really assert ourselves if we are going to take on the entirety of the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. I mean, ISIS seems to be now, apparently they captured a large amount of gold bullion reserves in the Mosul Central Bank. So now they have a decent amount of funding as well. So I'm sort of getting worried that this could potentially be a fairly long, not necessarily conflict, but sort of simmering civil war. So the US will probably get involved and be continued to get involved with airstrikes and drone strikes and stuff like that. On the one hand, that's better than American troops on the ground. On the other hand, you worry, will that actually affect the course of things, or are we just blowing stuff up to blow stuff up? So, this is an extremely complicated situation, and it just seems like there aren't going to be any good outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, this is not your grandmother's insurgency. They have mobile missile launchers and things like that, and as Nate said, are very well funded. Nate, what do you think about this sort of pledge that we're hearing kind of informally from the Obama administration to protect Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish regional government, at basically all costs?
I mean, I've advocated for years now to basically withdraw from Iraq and just support the Kurds. They seem to be our only real allies in the region. I mean, and this is going back decades now. I've always thought that Iraq probably should just be split into three different states or something along those lines, with the Kurds having their own independent state in the north. I still think that that's the way this is eventually going to go. And I think under no circumstances should the U.S. let the Kurdish region fall to ISI, Levant, or whatever. I mean, whether that's supplying them with guns, whether that's at some point putting military, I don't want to say military advisors, because they'll be fighting too. That's something I'd be willing to consider. Not necessarily trying to reconquer Iraq, but just shore up their defenses. I doubt that will happen, but I think that we need to, use our various forms of technology, drone strikes, stuff like that, to at least protect them. I don't know if we should really go about trying to roll back all of the Islamic State's progress, but I don't want to see Kurdistan fall.
Right.
So we're, this is we're and of course we need to get Turkey involved in this, because obviously they are impacted by this as well. I don't think that the US should just start going it alone, start blowing stuff up just to do it. But as I said, the Kurds have been our allies for decades now, and I think it would be exceedingly irresponsible to basically just abandon them to their fate. It's an extremely difficult situation. So just we have to hope that the various steps we've taken so far and the arms we've given the Kurds will allow them to sort of hold off Islamic State for until they sort of just retreat and sort of try to consolidate in the main Sunni regions. And hopefully it'll just sort of simmer down for a while. But it's always a little dangerous predicting a lack of conflict in the Middle East.
Right, so protection of the Kurds, containment of the ISIS advance, but maybe not trying to take on ISIS fully or defeat them.
That's just going to be Iraq War 2.0. I mean, and we thought the insurgency was bad. This apparently is the veterans of that insurgency with better weapons and better funding. So.
Now, Nate, I'm not sure if you saw this, but you mentioned several times here about how the Kurds have been our allies for a really long time. We sort of owe them at this point. To the other side of the spectrum, I'm not sure if you saw this, but the Sadrist politicians, those are the ones who are aligned with Muqtada al-Sadr, who are, they're Shia politicians, but specifically from the Sadrist bloc. Some of them were apparently throwing anonymous tantrums to the New York Times saying, well, they're only helping because it's the Kurds that are in danger. And where were they? Why weren't they giving weapons to the Shia paramilitaries? And why weren't they giving weapons to the Sunnis to resist this and blah, blah, blah. I was wondering what your take on that was, given the long history that the Sadrists have had with the U.S. forces after the
Yeah, I was going to say,
2003
maybe if
invasion.
the Sadrists wanted the U.S.'s help, they probably shouldn't have been fomenting a civil war and fighting with us for the past, like 8 years or whatever. Ever since the beginning of this sort of conflict, I've been willing to engage the Shiite side and think there's a lot of political benefits for the U.S. to ally itself with elements of the Shiites, maybe not necessarily in opposition to the Sunnis, because we have Sunni allies as well in Saudi Arabia, elsewhere. But I think that the U.S. cannot afford to sort of take one side in this ethnic or religious conflict within Islam, just because there are so many Shiites both in Iraq, Iran,
Right.
all over the world that are seemingly growing in political influence within the past decade. So I.
But we can certainly afford not to give weapons to the people who actually attacked U.S. forces
Oh yeah.
repeatedly.
Well, I was just reading some horrific incidents online the other day about from U.S. soldiers that were saw some of the atrocities committed by the Sadrites. So, and I've never really wanted them to be our sort of
Go-to
Shiite
Shiite, yeah.
militia. Yeah, but at the same time, you sort of have to recognize the various factions and how they're sort of all interplaying off of each other. There were some like CNN specials like, oh, the five wars in Iraq that I watched a couple years ago. And while it was a little bit exaggerated, this is really a multifaceted conflict. And just because your enemy has like fought with you, in this case, the Sa'darites, doesn't mean that they're not also fighting with your other enemies, ISIS.
Right.
So.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you're taking almost like a sort of public diplomacy approach to the whole, Sunni Shiite debate. Like, are you saying that we kind of just like need to find some Shiites to ally ourselves with for that image? Or are you, what are the specific groups, though?
Well, certainly not the Sa'darites,
Right.
that's for sure. But I mean, I just think that we're doing ourselves a bit of a disservice, or we have in the past, by sort of exclusively allying ourselves with the Sunnis. And then that led to a decent amount of problems at the beginning of the Iraq campaign. Basically, what I'm saying is, I don't think we should rule out engaging with Shiites, but basically, Sadr is probably not the right person to engage with.
Right, but we can't not be engaging with at
Yeah.
least some of the Shias. Persephone, did you have any other thoughts on any of these situations?
Yeah, I'm just especially concerned about the refugee situation. I mean, people have been saying really positive things about Turkey's camps for Syrian refugees, but I mean, they must be reaching kind of their limit in terms of resources. And in general, there's just such a big situation of refugees around the world, and I'm just concerned about the effects of this particular crisis on Turkey's resources, and also in terms of, is this going to result in more of an infrastructure for that kind of thing? How's the international community going to deal with? Obviously, we're not talking about a huge amount of refugees in comparison to the current amount. I mean, but it's I just hope that this will be handled with well, especially when you're once again looking at, a minority group which might not find itself in a situation where it will be well received where it ends up.
Right. There were some other situations as well regarding the Mosul Dam and things like that. I think I might have also mentioned Lebanon on the website, but we are out of time on this segment. So I would just direct people to go to arsenalfordemocracy.com for more analysis of, the sort of threat levels that those things pose and maybe why some of the media reports are potentially a little exaggerated or some of them aren't really emphasizing the right things enough. But anyway, Nate, thank you so much for joining us from Maine for this week's episode.
Yeah, no problem.
And Persephone, thank you for joining me in studio.
Of course.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.